I am thrilled to have Professor Jonathan Jansen in the studio today. Remember, we're live on Facebook, so do head over to our Facebook page to check out the live video. Jonathan is here to chat about his latest book, As by Fire, The End of the South African University. After 7 years as the Vice Chancellor of the University of Free State and in the wake of the student protests of 2015-2016, Jonathan resigned in September last year, and he's taken a break from the spotlight to spend time as a fellow at his alma mater, Stanford University in California. And in the book, he poses the question, will the student protests destroy or enhance these institutions? I believe this book should be required reading for every South African because it offers a very unique perspective. It's an aerial view from you, Jonathan, and from the 11 other vice chancellors tasked with running our universities. What do you hope people will take away from this book?
Good afternoon, Melanie, and your viewers, your listeners. Look, I think the most important thing for me is that people read this book as a warning about what could happen to the public higher education system in South Africa if we don't change course. And so on the one hand, it is a celebration, especially in 2015, of the importance of the student voice and the student activism and its broad base and its non-racialism and its largely non-violent form in raising issues of a systemic nature. That is, you can't just try and rescue the system by giving out money here and there. You needed to fundamentally deal with the issue of access to higher education. That was the big question. At the same time, it takes a turn for the worse. After October 2015 into 2016, when it becomes very violent, very racist, very sexist, and threatens, in my view, the future of higher education. Higher education, universities are not, you know, normal organizations in society. Universities are places in which you value reason above rage. If you can't reason your way out of a problem, if you can't apply the faculties to thinking about how you create a better campus and or better country, then of course you shouldn't have universities. You should just have political organizations. And so the book is both, as I said, a tribute to what has been done usefully through the student voice in the first part of that movement, but also warning about how it went south and could go further south. Like other African universities, we are not unique. South Africa is not special, you know. And so I'd like people to get a sense of not disaster and darkness and the end of the university, so to speak, but about what we need to do to change course and make sure that South Africa always has a vibrant university system on the African continent.
The last chapter is called A Ray of Hope.
Yeah.
By the time I got there, I was needing a ray of hope. What can people actually do?
I think, first of all, we need to affirm the value of universities. You know, the old notion, you remember when people sort of spoke about universities as, you know, the ivory tower. I've worked in universities all my life. It's not an ivory tower. We deal with students who are poor, with students who are smart, with students who are ambitious, with students who want to do things with their lives. I myself, as a vice chancellor, before and during and after, I'm involved in the community. I'm involved in schools. So are my researchers, my teams, and the resources we're able to raise. So the university is not something separate from or above the din of everyday life in South Africa. And so we need to recognize, first of all, that without universities, you don't really have a vibrant democracy. You're not going to have the high-level skills that you need. You know, I just spent 10 months in a familiar place to me, which is the heart of the Silicon Valley in Palo Alto, California. Let me tell you something. I am jealous as a South African about what kids learn there, what kids are able to do there, the opportunities that they have to create the next world economy. Why can't we do that? But you cannot do that without universities.
But yet you've also written in a column about some failures in their education system. I remember a column you wrote about that horrific class that you taught.
I know. And so their challenge is, how do you bring all schools, including the school where I taught for a day in East Oakland, how do you bring, but that's a minority. That's really a few schools in a largely successful system. How do you bring all of their schools, and that's when I was speaking to the American system, to be able to perform at peak as the schools, you know, that benefit directly from the technology boom?
You talk a lot in the book about systemic failures starting at school level. since you published, the Department of Basic Education has consulted on amendments that could see maths removed as a compulsory pass requirement. What do you think that means for universities?
You know what? I sleep reasonably well at night. You know, it would take a bomb to wake me. But I've been awake the past few nights. And one of the reasons for that is that instead of fixing the problem at the level of inputs, that is, quality teachers, teaching foundation phase mathematics well to all kids so that they do well in math, we look at the end of the school system and say, geez, the kids are not doing very well. Let's lower the standard. That's not the way you build a competitive world-class school system, you know. And so I think the department is mad. I think that they, you know, they sinking to the lowest common denominator here. They're trying to make themselves look good politically. That's not the way to do it. You know, there's one of my favorite scenes from what I think is a political commentator, this Leon Schuster thing, you know. Remember the policeman trying to describe, you know, the body lying on the pavement, but he can't spell pavement. So instead of saying it's on the pavement, he kicks the body into the slit, you know, and he says, okay, the body's in the road. That's what we're doing. Instead of trying to fix the problem where it is, we're making it easier by lowering the standard. I think we will pay a heavy price if we continue down this road. We already have the 30 and 40% pass. Imagine saying if you have 20%, you'll pass anyway. No, I have taught children in North America. I've taught children throughout Southern Africa. I can tell you there's nothing wrong with South African kids, provided you give them all the same opportunity to learn. And that means high-quality teachers, and that means a department that sets the bar high.
The reality is that's not happening at the moment.
Right.
You're talking about a collapse in universities within the next 2 to 3 years,
yeah.
You say. What do you say to parents and young students about our children's future if leaving the country isn't an option and these universities are on the verge of collapse?
Look, I say to parents, fight for the rights to education of your child, okay? Stand up to thugs who, in the name of democracy, you know, would attack our universities. You can't burn on a Friday what you need on a Monday. You just can't do that. I don't care how noble you think your cause is as a so-called activist, but if you're going to start burning down buildings in a poor country, somebody's going to pay for that, okay? And somebody's going to lose out on education. So I think the first thing is we need to say to our parents, instead of just thinking about you and your child, think about the future of this country, think about the future of its campuses, and stand up. Yes, side with the students on the issues, but don't speak well of or remain silent in the face of the destruction of our institutions. And that is something that the book brings out very clearly. Having said that, we still have very good universities in our country. There's no question about that. I don't want to name them because that causes other
problems. And institutions that have been around for...
And institutions for a century. We have a half a dozen universities that are over 100 years old. They survived apartheid. They survived some fairly brutal, you know, decades in our history. So universities, fortunately, don't fall over simply because of a student protest. But... That is also true of universities from East Africa, Southern Africa, West Africa, that if you don't stop the rot, then, of course, middle-class people, in particular those who have options, take their kids to the West.
At the ANC's recent policy conference, ANC Youth League calling for free higher education, Jacob Zuma saying there was going to be robust discussion. It doesn't seem like government is changing the trajectory. So what's going to change government?
Look, I'm with those people who say, if you're going to have free higher education, say what that means. Now, let me tell you what I think is achievable. I think it is possible to give free higher education to the poor. We should not give free higher education to professors like me. I should pay for my children's education because I earn enough money to do that. We should not give free higher education to that. Because what that does in consequence, there's a lot of evidence for this, is you in fact increase the inequalities between those who can and those who can't. So I think free education for the poor is a good thing. But then you've got to say what it is for. Accommodation and tuition, it turns out, is not enough to keep the poorest kids in university. You have to think about public transport. You have to think about books, textbooks, and facilities. You have to think about a whole lot of other things, including, by the way, as we did at the University of the Free State, something as simple as food. Where do I get a predictable meal from when I'm dirt poor? So If we say free, we've got to say what that means, but you must not reduce that debate, as some students demand, as free for everyone, because then we sunk.
We talked about having students on the program, perhaps having somebody from government. Do you think the time for constructive debate has passed? Where's the common ground? Because you said it could descend into shouting and insults.
Look, it is there right now. I mean, you know, not a week goes by where there isn't some collapse of a public discussion on a campus, because somebody believes that by shouting and screaming and insulting that you actually in the university, you're not. Okay. And so I speak out very strongly against that kind of behavior, because the only way we're going to solve these problems is by having government and, you know, workers and unions and students and university academics sit in the same room and figure it out. You know, I really don't know how to solve these problems apart from thinking about it and taking action and changing course. But what we've seen over the past few years, particularly 2016 forward, was, you know, an attempt to silence people, an attempt to sort of say, my voice matters and to hell with your voice. I'm sorry. That doesn't make these institutions universities. It makes them political organizations, and that we can't afford, that we cannot afford.
Fees Commission report was supposed to be out on the 30th of June. Do you think it will help?
No. The Fees Commission report, like all commissions of our government, are delaying tactics, you know, and that is why I understood some of the activist students sort of saying, why are you having these reports? You know what the problem is, like the black professor's problem, you know. The minister said, we need an investigation into why there are so few black professors. Well, I can tell you that. There's studies that have been done, use your head, you know. So I think instead of sort of having these commission reports which you delay and postpone and rewrite their briefs, simply deal with the issue about how are we going to fund the poorest of the poor. My own view is they shouldn't have to pay and they should be supported broadly in a poor country and so on, and have the middle classes and the wealthy pay for higher education so that we can, in fact, subsidize, as we should, the education of poorer people. It's as simple as that. And then stand your ground. And don't give in to people who say everybody should fight, because that cannot happen. And by the way, if you gave me a pot of money and you sort of said, where in the chain of education in South Africa would you put that money? I actually wouldn't put it in universities. I would put this in primary school. I would build up a solid foundation for young children so that they're numerate, literate, computerate, etc., and build the base of people who can, in fact, finish. Remember, 500,000 of the kids who started in grade 1 don't reach grade 12 in South Africa. So who are you talking about? A very small group at the top who make noise and jump over the gates of parliament and get attention. That's fine. But actually, we should be focusing on building the base of our education system so that more kids, young people, can participate.
An SMS coming through saying, I have huge respect for the professor. Rational, sane, objective. We need so many more people like him. From Dennis. I agree. The question is, are people like you talking to the people that can make the changes?
Look, we talk all the time. And, you know, whether it is through the Higher Education Association, whether it is as I feel, I can contribute, which is to write. And so, as you know, on Thursdays in the Times column, this book and other books that are coming out tries to speak to the South African public and to government in a way that says, here's evidence, here are arguments, here are positions, and so on and so forth. So I think people do read and take account. However, in South Africa, politics dominates at the moment, not evidence, not argument, not outsiders like myself. And that's a really great danger when, the 20% math or the non-compulsory math proposal. I mean, that's a response to politics. That's not a response to the evidence that unless you have a numerate society that can compete in a global economy, you are, you know, as a country, you're going to be screwed. So I think we have a responsibility, certainly those of us in the academic world, to keep making those arguments and to make sure that the public rallies behind those arguments, because I don't believe South Africa should stand back in any way when it comes to competing in the global economy and in international education.
A week ago on Twitter, you wrote, 10 glorious months came to an end today, 3 books done, 3 on the way, refreshed and ready to make hope happen in education throughout our still beautiful country. There's a suggestion here from Tom that you should be our Minister of Education. Do you see a future role like that? What will your role be back in South Africa?
I don't know yet, but I have no political ambitions, to be honest with you. If in a new government post 2019 there is a call to come and help in rebuilding the school system in particular in South Africa, I think I will now do that at a political level. Do I want to become a politician? No. Do I want to sit in Parliament and spend several hours insulting people back and forth? No. Do I want to get involved and get my hands dirty in political office and make sure things actually change at the level of schools? Of course I'd love to do that. But that's a recent position.
Let's talk a bit about the personal attacks, because that was a hard chapter to read. Hmm. Personal attacks on you and other vice chancellors. I think for you, there was the hashtag Janssen must fall, and you were accused of promoting white supremacy and all sorts of things. Do you think that perception still exists, and do you care now that you've had a chance to step back from what was an incredibly intensive time?
First of all, I think that when it came to public and personal attacks, I really didn't get the brunt of all of that. I think other vice chancellors, like my colleague at the Northwest and at UCT and Rhodes, I thought they had a really, really unfair and very tough challenge when it came to personal attacks. And at my own university, the people who were doing that was a small group, I would say less than 1% of the student body. So I could take perspective and say, this is a few groups, who are sort of bought, in fact, by the outside political agencies. And so I didn't take them seriously. I listened much more to the majority of the students for whom the university was on the right course, both in relation to its academic project of high quality, high standards for all students, and then helping them get there. And in terms of rebuilding after 100 years, the relationships across racial lines. Does that mean it always goes forward? No. You will be severely challenged precisely because you're moving. And so there's not a day that goes by, whether it's on campus or in the country or internationally, where people don't say, you guys are doing the right thing, keep going on. And that's a great encouragement.
Your writing also shows a frustration with the press for not always telling the whole story. Do you think the whole story, because there's so much in your book that surprised me, and I'm a journalist, but was the whole story available to them then?
Look, I think all over the world, you get the press and you get the press. And I am somebody who believes fundamentally in the freedom of the press and that people must write what they think and write what they want to and so on and so forth. I obviously also believe that there's truth and there's lies, and that good journalism, there's a big difference. I'm a subscriber now over the past couple of years to international newspapers. And there's a really big difference between the New York Times and the New York Post, between the, et cetera. And I think in South Africa, I see too few New York Times quality, level, depth, sustained, invested journalism and more sort of headline journalism. The students are angry. Who are the students?
Sound bites, quick.
Quick
sound.
Who are the students? Is it all 33,000 students at the University of Free State, or is it 300 of them that just gathered in the public square? Do you know what I'm saying? I don't have a sense of unpacking what does this mean. It's too much focus on the fantastic, on the, and then you of course put out, as a note on social media, send us your pictures live. I love the press, and I really do. I write for the press, and I would love to see a whole lot more reporting. But I also would like to see something that gets the public thinking about what's happening rather than reacting only to the headlines.
Were you in Twitter purgatory? Because that's where during the protest, that's where a lot of the communication was happening and still happens.
Look, I've got 93,000 followers on Twitter. I use that, as every single day to get out, first of all, positive messages about our country and our schools and so on, but also to warn about things that are not wrong. So I didn't, in fact, unlike many university presidents, as they call them in other parts of the world, I wasn't scared of Twitter and social media. I took to it. I also blocked people who were racist and sexist and very personal.
And not adding to the conversation.
And not adding richness to the conversation. So I do that all the time. But I think the way in which, unfortunately, in the 21st century, to engage as a leader is not to shirk or, you know, draw away from social media, but to engage on social media platforms and get out your message.
A question coming through on SMS. Good day. The higher education system in the future should be through internet. Students sitting at home at a computer, if they're not happy with circumstances, they can do something to their parents' house. It will be much cheaper to administer.
I think the evidence shows across the world that the people who benefit from online education are not undergraduate poor students. In fact, they fail like flies when that happens. There's a lot of evidence to that. The people who benefit from that model of education tend to be working adults doing part-time studies and from middle-class communities. And that makes sense. Undergraduate teaching involves face-to-face contact for the main part. It requires you take students to do undergraduate education through UNISA. Okay, you would find that the dropout rate and the failure rate is much higher than in residential universities. There's a reason for that. Okay, you don't have the intensity of contact of exchange with a lecturer in real time and all of that. So I think there's a place for that model of education. I don't think it works, particularly in poorer communities. And by the way, neither does it work in fairly middle and upper middle class communities, because undergraduate education students want an experience that is more than the online facility.
Yet you point in the book, and I see it's something that Adam Habib talked about yesterday in the Sunday Times as well, that WITS now has to cut its budget to allow for insourced workers. Mm-hmm. And the question was asked to him, with government subsidies falling, student numbers rising, is your current situation sustainable even with budget cuts? And his answer is no. And that's really the crux of your book, isn't it?
Listen, Adam is, you know, fortunately one of those people who calls it like it is. And when I read that exchange with Chris Barron, of course he's right and honest about it. We are in trouble. So, you know, you can hit university vice chancellors and institutions over the head, you know, with a hammer and sort of say, find more money. But, you know, this is not America. This is a poor country at the tip of the continent. And so where's the money going to come from when everybody makes demands? Pay for this. I don't want to pay for that. Insource every worker, which, by the way, is right and just. But you also have to ask, how do you do that, okay, when you don't have money? Because it's no use you insource every worker and the next day you can't take in another 1,000 students who are poor because you don't have the money, or you can't hire more lecturers for smaller class instruction and so on. So we need to be very careful about just doing what is popular and populist and not also asking how do we sustain this. You know, I think of universities as sort of jewels in the crown of a country's, you know, social and cultural system. Destroy them and you have nothing.
And you certainly break down all of that in the book.
Right.
I mean, step by step, you explain why things are going the way that they are. We don't have much time. Can you just talk briefly about decolonized education? Because your chapter on that is very interesting in the book. And I give you like 1.5 minutes to do it.
Look, first of all, you know, as social scientists, we are trained to be suspicious of emerging concepts in a society. And when people just throw out words like decolonize, this, that, and the other, you know, radical economic transformation. So my eyes, you know, go wide. Sort of, do people just use words in our country without thinking? We're not a colonial society, okay? We were not under colonial rule since the British left, you know, in 1910. We've had a lot of apartheid, of course. And yes, nor have we stood still as a society. So to pretend by using the word decolonization that people like Frantz Fanon, Albert Memmi, and Aimé Césaire were writing about post-colonial or constitutional democracies. They were writing about anti-colonial struggles. So there is a clumsiness, a messiness, a dishonesty, in my view, by throwing out these terms without asking. Unless, of course, you believe that every white South African is a colonial, you know. Now, nobody believes that really anymore, but it's a useful point if you try, if you're angry and you're trying to get back at someone and so on and so forth. So I think that what scared me is that there weren't enough academics sort of say, wait, before you throw out this term, can we just try and unpack it, to use a South African word, and ask what does this mean and does it apply to us in the 21st century? So I am not at all taken, you know, by this lobbying of all kinds of useful words at one point in time into a constitutional democracy as if we're simply a reflex of our colonial past.
Professor Jonathan Jansen, if you'd like to know more about his thoughts, buy the book. It really should be required reading for every South African. It's called As by Fire, The End of the South African University. It is available in major bookstores across the country. As Ferial Haffagee writes on the cover, it's a view from the inside of the cauldron, and Jonathan certainly doesn't mince his words.